Welcome, everybody. It's a real pleasure to speak to you today. My name is Dan Wallach. I'm a professor at Rice University, and I'm going to be telling you about some work we've done doing a static analysis for security purposes of LLVM bitcode, which is the way you might do a native Tizen application. First, I should tell you that if any of you have any questions, please go up to one of the microphones, so that way the people who aren't here or people coming afterwards can hear you, rather than me having to restate the question. Right, okay. So first, I should mention that this is ongoing work at Rice. Samsung has been generous in supporting us, and I don't speak for Samsung. I have no idea what their product plans are. I have no idea if anything that we're building will have any reflection on anything that might ever see the light of day. I'm a researcher, not a product guy. Important caveat. This is the work of a large team of people at Rice. Also, for those of you who are taking pictures of every slide, I've given a PDF to the organizers. They'll be happy to get you my slides so you can relax and enjoy the talk. Think about questions that you want to ask. There's going to be lots of animations. You'll be clicking vigorously if you want to get it all. All you have to do is relax and enjoy, and I'm sure the organizers will be happy to get you a copy of the slides. All right. Anyway, let me tell you about a security problem and how we might go about solving it. So we have an app store of some sort. People submit apps, and before those apps go out to the users, we might want to have a look at the apps and say, this one's good, this one's bad. How are you going to do that? Well, you could imagine having a human analyst with a disassembler of some sort trying to go through or just run them and try to reach some conclusion, good or bad. That's going to be slow, painful, and not terribly accurate. Things will get through that you didn't notice. You could try to have a process that's completely automated, completely in a box without any human analyst at all, but then that becomes something that malicious developers can figure out. They can game it. They can get stuff through. So we're looking at a hybrid model here. The model is we want to have a computationally assisted human analyst. The theory then is that the human analyst is given an automated analysis. The computer does a whole bunch of work in advance and gives you a report that helps the human analyst reach a conclusion. And then we want some feedback where the human analyst can then help train the automated system for what they think is appropriate. So think computer-aided human. Don't think completely automatic. That's our goal. This contrasts with Apple's policy, which I guess is only vaguely understood, and Google's policy, which is completely black box and there's no human in the loop at all. We're trying to do something in between those two points. A diagram that you've seen many times today and yesterday and the day before, there are two different kinds of ways that you might build a Tizen app. You might build a native app, you might build a web app. This earlier talk before me this morning, you heard about building hybrids in between. Today, what I'm talking about is I'm talking about the native apps. I'm not talking at all about web apps, and I'm not talking about hybrids. Today, we're talking about LLVM bitcode apps, So for those of you who are less familiar, LLVM is the low-level virtual machine. This is an infrastructure where you write in your favorite high-level language, C, C++, what have you. You compile it, and the output is this stuff called LLVM. And then that, think of it as analogous to Java bytecode or a Dalvik bytecode or something like that. It's an intermediate representation, and then you can compile it for the platform later. And there are some very sophisticated tools in the LLVM universe that can do very good optimizing compilation of the bytecode into the actual running program. So LLVM is actually a really great way to ship code, even though it wasn't necessarily meant for that purpose, because it was designed to be analyzed, it was designed to be optimized. It's the intermediate representation of a high-performance compiler. And what that means is it maintains enough of the original source code semantics that you can do optimizations that require you to otherwise reconstruct all of that when you're looking at, say, machine code. Now you actually can see the original source semantics, and that helps you do high-performance optimizations. LLVM bytecode is also independent of any particular machine. So if somebody wanted to do an x86 versus an ARM versus a MIPS versus whatever, you could use the very same LLVM bit code and then retarget it later on, you know, either at distribution time or at install time or what have you, without the original programmer having to worry about the target architecture. LLVM deals very well with multiple source languages. It's not like the Java universe where Java bytecode is really maps very closely to the Java source language. And when other languages want to target Java bytecode, it's not a good fit. LLVM was engineered to be that better fit. LLVM is open source. It's something that you can pick up and mess with. Notably, Apple has integrated into their Xcode toolchain. So this is industrial performance stuff. It was built for compiler purposes, and it turns out to be really good for security purposes, too. Everything that makes it good from the perspective of I want to build a high-performance optimized compiler also makes it good from the perspective of I want to study this program statically or dynamically to analyze it, what its behavior is, and decide whether I think that's okay or not okay. So the usual pipeline: you write your source application, say you're a C++ developer, you compile it, and now you get this LLVM bitcode file. Then that you'll ship, perhaps to an app store provided by Samsung or perhaps by somebody else. Then there will be a static analysis process that consumes this bitcode and some security rules that where analysts have tried to encode a bunch of knowledge from their head about what they think is allowed and what they think should be forbidden. The output of that is some kind of report that says, here's what passes and here's what fails. Then that goes to a human analyst. The human analyst looks at the report and says, this looks interesting, this I don't believe, this looks like this requires further analysis. And ultimately, the human analyst will build new rules. The human analyst will say, right, that rule turned out to be giving me too many false positives, and that rule turns out to be really important, or I'm going to update that rule based on things that I've learned. So this, the circular, you know, notion of analysts improving rules, making better analysis to help make better rules, is integral to the process that we envision for how you might study security of applications. So what do you want to analyze? It's easy to imagine blacklists. You know, if you call this API function, you're forbidden. That's easy. That's almost too easy. We want to do something actually a little bit fancier. We want to be able to do information flow policies. These are intuitive to state. For example, information from the GPS should not flow to the network. And you don't really care how it might flow from the GPS to the network, except that's something that we might consider bad. And you can think of lots of other examples. Flow from the contacts to the network. Flow from the contacts to the Bluetooth. Flow from, you know, flows of sensitive user information to places where it might get out of the device beyond the user's control. And we can write, when you state this as an information flow policy, it not only captures your intuition, but it also admits for things that might, like say in an Android universe would require, like an Android, you'd have to ask for a location permission if you wanted to ever know your location. But imagine you were doing, say, an offline mapping tool. You know, it's like you preload the phone with all the maps for your country, and then the phone just wants to do navigation in a completely offline fashion. In the Android universe, you'd have to request location permission. In this universe, you wouldn't. You would just say, because the location never left the device, then you would have no reason to need the permission. So this style of information flow policy might enable you to do applications that don't have to scare the users by asking for a dangerous permission. These are the kinds of policies we'd like to be able to enforce. So here's a little sample of something that looks vaguely like C code that I threw together to try to explain how this might work. So this is a very simple program, and here at the top, it just says if the time is sufficiently different from the last time I checked, then please get the new location and save it somewhere. And every once in a while, I might send a string home to my home server that says, here I am. Okay, this is a very, very simple program. So if we're going to analyze this program, we need what's called a taint source. This is where the dangerous information begins. So here, when I say, give me the location, that's the beginning of something dangerous. And then we want to propagate this tainting. You know, we want to propagate the notion that, whoa, here's something that's dangerous or derived from something that's dangerous. And ultimately, we need to make sure that we need to look for places where there are taint sinks, where the tainted data could get out of the device. So here I've labeled the network sending method as the thing that might be dangerous. And there are all these places in between where we go from one variable to the next variable, and we need to track every place where the tainted information might flow. And we even have to worry about these sort of conditionals. There are places in your code where, from an analysis perspective, you're not sure whether you're going to take this branch or not. And this is the sort of thing where, statically, it's a little bit more complicated to understand what does that branch mean. So when you do a static analysis, when you're not actually running the program, you might then assume that every branch is taken, sort of a worst-case analysis. Likewise, you have to worry about pointers. If I have a pointer to an object of a certain type, how do I know which instance of that object of that type? Do I mash them all together and pretend that there's just one instance, so anything that flows into one instance flows into all of them? These sort of pointer aliasing issues can create analysis ambiguities or complexities. And likewise, object-oriented method dispatch. When you invoke a method on an object, you don't know which instance it's going to go to, and you probably don't necessarily even know which type or subtype of the class that it's going to. So here's a call site. You say foo.toString. Well, where is that going to go? At runtime, you have vtables or other data structures to help you figure out where the target of that call site is. Statically, you can't always know. So the challenge when doing this analysis is a trade-off between being very conservative and trying to assume the worst case, that it could go anywhere, that it could be anything, which would mean that you would definitely catch any problem, but that would also generate a huge number of false positives. So the trade-off in doing any kind of static analysis is trying to give good quality results without missing anything subtle. This is what makes static analysis hard. Now, the underlying machinery of doing the control flow and data flow analysis, figuring out all the places how this value flows into that value, largely builds on tooling that's already built into any optimizing compiler. These are things that the compiler already worries about when it's trying to make your program go faster. Oh, this value is never needed anymore, so then I'll reuse that register for something else. Compilers already do that sort of analysis. From a security perspective, it's a little bit trickier. You want to start adding some new features that the optimizing compiler doesn't need. A typical example is what's called declassifying. So imagine that if you have tainted input, it starts spreading, and anything that touches that value now is tainted, and before long, everything in your program is tainted. And that's not a helpful analysis. So you might want to have a way that you can annotate the program that says, even though this looks like it's tainted, trust me, I know what I'm doing. And that kind of annotation then removes the taint and says, yes, I know normally this is bad, but trust me, I, the analyst, hereby bless this value. You know, I've taken this location and I've removed the low order bits, so now I'm plus or minus 100 miles rather than plus or minus a meter. And by virtue of that higher, lower precision, I've declared that I no longer need to. That might be a policy, and even though strictly one is derived from the other, I might have a security policy that says when you do this, that's okay. And so you need to have an operator for the analysis system to be able to say, yes, I know we're making an exception to the rules. So as I've mentioned, false positives are a big problem. So our pragmatic solution is that we're going to try to come up with a way of building heuristics and sorting these things. We want to be able to make the most likely or most interesting or most severe or most interesting to the analyst things bubble up to the top, so that way the analyst can focus his or her attention where it's most important. So this is purely a heuristic process. So for example, let's say there's a shorter distance in terms of lines of code touched or methods passed through or something like that between a source and a sink. The closer they are in space, the closer the source and the sink are in the code, the more likely that that could be a vulnerability that perhaps could be exploited by a third party. Because if a hacker is analyzing code looking for a vulnerability, you know, they're only human and they're looking for things that are easier to exploit. So that would be a heuristic that might bubble that dangerous flow higher up in the list. Likewise, if the source is something that we consider more sensitive to the user, like your fine GPS location or your contacts list, that might be higher priority than, say, your IMEI number. And likewise, perhaps the more conditionals you pass through, the more method dispatches you pass through, each of those makes it harder and harder for an attacker to exploit a vulnerability. So again, that might make it lower severity. So again, all of these things, as I mentioned at the beginning, I could sit down and I could write 20 rules today and say, I'm done, I'm ready to ship. But there's no way I can get it right. There's no way anybody can sit down and envision what all the right rules are in advance. And that's why we imagine that there will be a process where apps come in, they're analyzed, and then there's a feedback loop where the analysts say, this rule is really great, this rule is not very great, and they're going to change the priorities and change the heuristics to try to help, in practice, get better results and better reports. And of course, the analysts aren't just learning from their own experience. They will make mistakes. There will be exploits. There will be developers who get away with stuff, and there will be the unfortunate news where, you know, people in the press figure it out and start saying, what's wrong with this? Then you have to go back and pull apps or do other bad things. Of course, security vulnerabilities happen. That's just the game. There have been attacks against Android. There have been attacks against iOS, and there will be attacks against Tizen. That just tells you your platform is popular. And when that happens, then you go and build new rules. You learn from your mistakes, you build new rules, and hopefully you help prevent it in the future. So let me now go under the hood a little bit and tell you a little bit about how you go about doing this sort of analysis. So I'm going to teach you briefly, those of you who've had a compiler class, bear with me, the rest of you, here's a little bit of Compiler 101. When we have a program, we need to transform it into a form that's more amenable to analysis. So here's a very, very simple program, and I've color-coded it. The taint sources are blue, the taint sinks are red, and we want to be able to figure out whether a taint source flows into a taint sink. So we're going to rewrite the program into a form called static single assignment, which I just did, you notice that there are now subscripts under the variables. So even in the source code, you just say x, but now I've got x0, x1, x2. The idea of static single assignment is you only ever write to a variable once ever. So then I know it, when I say x1, it means exactly one thing. There's never any ambiguity about what I mean when I say x1. Now, because I had a branch here, you know, this branch might have changed the value of x depending on the conditional. So when you do static single assignment, you need a way of merging back together. You know, it's all the same x. How do I do that? Well, so I created an x2, and I have what's called a phi function, that's the Greek letter phi, that says, well, one of these two is the actual value that will flow into x2. Which one? That's determined at runtime. So this is the way you rewrite a program into SSA form, and this makes it easier to do analysis. Now I can look at Y1, and I can directly just look at, well, what flowed into Y1? Well, X1. What flowed into X1? Oh, a taint source. Done. This is nothing more sophisticated than a breadth-first search through a graph. It's very straightforward. Now at this point, I can look at that, at the second taint sink, and I can say this uses X0, and X0 was never tainted. So I can say that even though there might be some complicated series of conditionals, I am certain that that's a legal flow. So SSA form makes it easier to do these sorts of analyses. And then, of course, X2 will inherit the taint from X1, and if anybody touches X2, then I consider that tainted. Of course, I have to worry about a lot of other subtle things. So, for example, here's Y0 inherit, you know, so in this case, Y0 gets either the value yes or no. So how do I know if Y0 is tainted? Because if we go through, because we go through this conditional branch, then Y0 depends, Y0 is tainted because the conditional depends on the taint source. But there's never a flow from X0 into Y0. So we call that a pseudo-use. When you're inside a conditional and the conditional branched on something that was tainted, then the fact that you are executing the statement or not executing the statement makes you tainted as well. So we have to worry about that. That no matter which side of this branch, you're still tainted because the conditional was tainted. And therefore, we could derive that this is a forbidden flow. This is the sort of thing where static analysis can do wonderful things that are very difficult to do dynamically. You know, at runtime, if you wanted to do, there's a research project a couple years ago called Taintroid that tried to do this at runtime for Android apps, they would not have been able to catch this sort of an information flow. But statically, it's very straightforward to do. So under the hood, really every variable is either has an extra label on it that's either untainted or tainted, and then we have a simple join algorithm, and we use the internal mechanisms inside LLVM with some modest extensions to be able to implement this. We worry about all the control dependencies, branches, and we have some optimizations to make this whole analysis go a little bit faster than the naive implementation. Not really exciting to this audience, but it goes fast, and I'll give you some performance numbers in a minute. So then we ran it. Samsung gave us 30 different apps that were native, that were, you know, the various apps that you get in a default Tizen instance, and they said, have a look at these, see what you can find. And we found a security bug. Well, not really, but we found one app that violated a rule that we wrote, and this was the Friend Finder, because it can flow information from your contacts list to Bluetooth. Now that's actually a feature, right? You know, that's how I can hold up my phone to you and say, you know, share a contact. But, you know, since we wrote a rule that said flowing from contacts list to network or Bluetooth is forbidden, sure enough, it flagged. And in fact, our analysis found no false positives or false negatives. It turned out to be very precise. So here's the actual code snippets that we were able to find from within this particular app. So our analysis works, but we're only just beginning. You know, we've looked at a small number of apps that Samsung gave us. We haven't, you know, looked at a giant app store of hundreds of thousands. Here's some speed. So along the x-axis, you can see a whole bunch of different apps by name, and you can see how big they are in terms of bit code instructions. That's not really interesting to know, but here are some performance numbers. The y-axis is in seconds. The x-axis shows you the different apps. Basically, this is running on a quad-core Xeon 2.6 machine, so a relatively modern, you know, Intel PC. These bars show total execution time. The blue part is the time for doing the actual static analysis, and then the red part is everything else. So you can see, in the worst case, we're talking about running for a second. And in the best case, we're talking about, you know, tens or hundreds of milliseconds. And in the grand scheme of things, you know, when we're talking about having a human analyst in the loop, this time is completely irrelevant. You know, this is just, it takes a human analyst that long to take the first sip of coffee. Then they're ready. So you can see that the actual, if you try to say performance divided by size of bitcode, like how fast can we digest bitcode, it's roughly the same. Some apps seem to be a little bit slower. There's a little bit more work in some. And this depends on things like the branching, you know, how branchy it is versus how straight line it is. But nonetheless, the performance is relatively consistent. This thing works. So, wrapping up, leaving plenty of time for questions, this thing works so far, and there's all sorts of interesting future analyses that we're considering where to go next. For example, right now we're simply analyzing the apps. We don't look at all at the system libraries. We don't look at the OS kernel. So trying to expand our analysis to digest all of the libraries and the entire system and everything, that would make things, you know, that would slow the performance down a little bit. And maybe we could do some optimization since it's the same library every time. You know, maybe we could do that analysis once and share it. Likewise, we have to, because we're only looking at the app, there's a lot of places where apps make calls and then there are callbacks to the apps. We had to special case all of that. If we could analyze the full library, then that would become a lot simpler. Likewise, it would be interesting to be able to run an app, you know, to annotate an app and run it, or do partial evaluation of an app, things that you could do at runtime in a virtual machine. We haven't even begun to think about how to do that, and I think that if you were going to do a production system, that would be mandatory. A static analysis is just one piece of an overall analysis. And we haven't looked at all at these HTML apps that many Tizen applications will probably be built in HTML and JavaScript, or in some hybrid of HTML, JavaScript, and native code. And if you were going to do this analysis in a production environment, you'd have to deal with that too. So our work has only just begun, and I think there's a lot of very exciting work to do here. At that point, I'd like to stop and take questions. Please use a microphone.
You mentioned the Tendroid work, and what you're doing, it's a static analysis opposed to what we were doing, but have you considered to do plant tools as a future work to consider the case of colliding apps?
Because colluding?
Colluding apps, because this is like becomes interesting, because one thing, if one developer just uses the taint and source and sync in one application, it's totally different if it submits to two apps who just communicate to each other, and then the sync and the source is in different applications.
Right. So one thing that you might consider, and then this becomes a policy question, you know, if you export an interface, should that be allowed or forbidden? If you export a general purpose interface that lets somebody call you and learn the location, is that okay or is that not okay? So you could think about it as an open world analysis. Maybe I want to forbid you from having a general purpose export system. Or maybe you could think of it as, now I need to do cross, you know, okay, you export an interface, who do I see in the entire universe who would ever use that interface? And now it becomes, you'd like to build a modular analysis, so that way I can summarize app one, and then I can summarize app two, and then I can do an analysis at a higher level. And then if you submit one app today and another app a week from now, I can say, wait a minute, these do a funny thing.
So this can be something really interesting for the App Store to be able to do. I don't think any App Store currently does these kind of things.
I know that there have been a number of vulnerabilities in Android where they exported, you know, intent or binder interfaces that specifically allowed callers to exploit them to do bad things. So that would be, and as far as I can tell, that's inadvertent. That wasn't malicious. But it's still something that the App Store needs to be able to catch.
But do you plan to have any future plans to go into that direction? Because I think that can be quite an interesting direction.
I think that would be absolutely interesting.
Thank you.
So looking at the rule sets that you create, do you believe that you're going to be able to create rule sets that can find generic, that can be generic to all apps that go through the App Store, or do they have to be crafted for specific types of apps?
I hope the rules can be generic. And what I anticipate is, as the analysts are building their rules and refining their rules, that there will be some classes of apps where rules just won't fit. You know, there will be some apps that, you know, let's say somebody wants to build a third-party dialer. It's going to flag a bunch of rules because it's using the contact list and it's making calls. And that ultimately needs to be the case where then, well, okay, do we want to allow this class of application into the store, yes or no? And let's pretend that we have different, I mean, okay, I'm not speaking for Samsung, but let's imagine that our store has different categories of apps. You know, games, utilities, and there might be some classes of application for which you don't just want to let anybody do it because those applications might be exercising more privileges or permissions than we would otherwise want. And so then, you know, yes, you would violate the rules that we would allow for games, but maybe that's okay in a different category.
Okay, and just as a follow-up as well, so one of the actually, I mean, I've looked at static analysis with LLVM quite a bit. One of the downsides to it is, unlike with a lot of commercial solutions like Clockwork and Coverity, it doesn't have a database that saves all of the results in the back end, so you can track the history of an application.
Right.
Do you see something like that as being valuable for this particular kind of work, being able to track that kind of history for an application?
So you're saying, like, over the long term, as a developer is submitting version 2 and version 3 and version 4 of the same app, it would be nice for judgments rendered by the analysts to be able to apply to the future apps. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very interesting place to go. And that requires thinking not just about analyzing applications, but how do annotations glue themselves onto applications as the application itself is mutating underneath. You know, an analyst might say, want to insert a declassification annotation that I know this flow is okay. Mm-hmm. How does that annotation glue onto the code? Really what we're talking about now is aspect-oriented programming. And aspect-oriented programming, where you write programs that rewrite your programs for you, is incredibly fragile and brittle for all these reasons. So I don't think that I'm going to be able to have an off-the-shelf solution for you. What I expect the answer might be, and again, I'm just making stuff up now, might be that there's a collaborative process between the analyst and the app developer, where the analyst says, I want you to put this annotation here. Mm-hmm. And then that annotation is now in their source code, and then it survives through the source code as the developer is modifying the application. And then the analysts know to look for the annotation, and then they might double check it, but the analyst asked the developer to put the annotation there, okay, perhaps. So that would be a way that they could have an ongoing communication.
Okay, thanks.
You mentioned that rules are created and modified all the time. What if you find a new rule which is super awesome and you want to go through all your 1 million applications in your app store? How does it escalate when you have a human interaction?
So what I imagine, and it's a very good question, what would probably happen if I was running the app store and I had my team of analysts, there's a finite amount of effort that they can produce. And so let's say you come up with a new rule and it turns out to be really valuable. Well, you can automatically run it against 100,000 apps. That's easy. You know, spin up a bunch of EC2 instances and you can parallelize this process. And if anything flags, then that goes into a queue for the humans to come back and reanalyze it. And if you have a rule that turns out to have a very low false positive rate that you're very confident in, then, you know, if you analyze 100,000 apps and 10 of them flag, well, then you should look at them right away.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. So how do you define the distance between the tainted source and tainted sync? Say, for example, if I want to make a malicious software, and in your previous slide you mentioned that say if the distance is longer, then the risk might be lower. But if I deliberately insert a big chunk of code with complicated logic, then perhaps I can...
Right. So there's really two perspectives on it. There's the perspective of an innocent application that we don't want to be accidentally exploitable. And the more complexity between source and sync actually makes it much harder for an attacker to find a path to exploit you. So that's really what I was talking about. In the malicious case, you know, if you're trying to obfuscate your program that's actually doing something evil, well, the flow is going to be there, and the tool will find the flow. And then it's a matter of the analyst having to say, what's going on here? And so if you're trying to get past an analyst, then the question is, what's the policies now? This is, we're talking about human policy. You know, when you get a program that's completely incomprehensible, how are you supposed to react to that? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how you would deal with that policy. I don't really know.
Okay.
Dan, can I add here?
Sure. With one of my collaborators, Michael Burke.
This is for your question. Yeah, we measure code distance in terms of conditionals along a path in the intra-procedural case and in the inter-procedural case in terms of the number of call sites invoked.
Continuing the rules. So you said that update of the rules happen either by the human going and updating the rules, saying this rule is better than another one, or when you're analyzing also the exploits. So while analyzing exploits and malware applications, do you use any machine learning, or do you try to kind of optimize that one, not that it's only like what if human sees that this is exploited, it tries to kind of manually put that data in as a rule?
So machine learning requires big data. Machine learning means I have to have a huge corpus that I can train on. And at least right now, there's no such corpus to train on. At least maybe I could train in the Android universe, but in the Tizen universe, I don't have that yet.
But do you need to be especially Tizen ops? Because, I mean, your method is not really tied to...
Right. So the way to understand... I mean, I'm not an expert in machine learning, but the way I understand it is that you build feature extraction tools. And all of these, everything I've described, all of these static analyses are feature extractors. Step one, take this incomprehensible blob and extract bits. Yes, this, no, that, yes, this, no, that. Step two is training. Mm-hmm. You figure out which bits are relevant to the thing that you wanted. But that means you have to have classification. Mm-hmm. You know, malware, goodware. If you have features and you have labels, then you can do machine learning. And so we already have features, and the analysts are going to be doing labels. So we could certainly do a machine learning back end on this. Absolutely.
I think it would be just beneficial because after this, for example, a big store kicks off, there would be a lot of malware in the beginning where you can actually use as a data, or when you can just utilize the other ones. So maybe you can partner with some malware vendors. So they sometimes are willing to provide their databases, I mean, of their fingerprints. And
right. So, like, for example, at least I know that in the Windows universe, there tend to be these behavioral patterns that the malware people use. You know, it's known that if you make this call and then you make that call, you can exploit something. Mm-hmm. And so if in the Tizen universe somebody discovers that there's a particular pattern, then this system could flag that pattern, and that could be something that is either just something that shows up for an analyst, or we could then train on it.
Mm. Thank you.
So it is really impressive to see that you have zero false positive. So I'm curious to know if you are using any kind of filtering or any kind of special thing.
Right. I mean, right now we're lucky because we have a very small data set and we happen to get zero false positives. What I expect when we have, instead of 30 apps, but 300,000 apps, we're not going to be so lucky. And that's what the heuristics are for. So and this is actually, I mean, Coverity does the same thing. Fortify does the same thing. I have all these rules that fire, and some of them are going to be useful and some of them aren't going to be useful. And the goal is to prioritize the ones that are most likely to be interesting to the analyst. And so just like Coverity makes no false positive or false negative claims. Coverity's claims are use our tool and it will give you useful feedback. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here. So we want to bubble the good stuff up to the top of the list.
And do you track the flow through the binaries, the libraries and the...
Today, no. That would be an excellent next step for us to pursue.
So you could have potentially false negatives.
Right now, we have a very simple model of the libraries. Like, we deal with callbacks from the libraries. And otherwise, it's absolutely possible that today we might be missing a flow through a library, although we do deal with callbacks. And I think doing the full analysis of the library and having that as a modular thing that we can plug back into an app analysis is one of the definite next steps.
Right now, we could also have false negatives for other people, where we are.
Yeah, this is very much work in progress. So I'm being told we need to wrap up, but I'll be around afterwards if you want to come chat in the hallway. Thank you very much.